This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December the 29th, 2014. This podcast is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Any use of this audio material without the written consent of Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2014 Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. We're here for the final week of 2014, taking a look at the developments here right toward the end of the year. And not surprisingly, given the holiday in the middle of the week, we don't have a whole lot of things that have happened, but we'll talk about some of the things that did happen and maybe take a look at how things are going and how things are closing out for the year. You all should be aware that we are now still trying to implement, to the extent you can, any of the planning opportunities that were involved in the late acts that Congress passed. Please remember that certain things like purchasing the 179 equipment needs to be done before the end of the year to place the items into service. We also have to worry about the fact that if anybody's trying to make that charitable contribution straight out of an IRA, that also is one that needs to be taken care of by the end of the year. So if you're listening to this before the 1st of January, you might want to remind your clients to make sure those things happened. Make sure anything that is a December 31st, 2014 item has been taken care of, especially those that Congress just now told us will apply for 2014. Going to this week's developments, let's turn to a private letter ruling, 2014-51-006. This one is interesting because it basically deals with a problem that we see quite often where a new preparer comes in, takes a look at a tax return that a previous preparer had prepared, and discovers issues with that return. In this particular case, a new preparer discovered, when looking through a tax return, that the prior preparer who had prepared a Form 1120-S had neglected to attach a Form 982. Now, that was important because the S corporation had owned an interest in a partnership that passed out cancellation of dead income, and the property would qualify for the real estate, for the qualified business real estate exemption from inclusion of cancellation of dead income with a reduction of basis. But in order to claim that, you must make an election that is timely made with the return. While the original preparer had excluded the cancellation of dead income, the original preparer had failed to attach a 982. In this case, the new preparer informed the client of the problem. A private letter ruling was requested, and in this case, as quite often is the case, the IRS goes ahead and approves a private letter ruling where, in fact, it does not turn out that there was anybody gained from the situation. Technically, the key issue here is the date was set by regulation. The IRS takes the position that they do have the authority to waive election dates if the election date is set by regulation. If the election date is set by statute and there's no specific statutory authority provided for the service to waive that date, the IRS position has always been they have no authority to make such a waiver. But in this case, that waiver works. When you have that waiver, then we can ask for a waiver, ask for relief under Regulation 301-9100-3. That relief provision allows us to get a late election relief if we ask for a private letter ruling, and we can demonstrate that the taxpayer provides evidence, including affidavits, that show the taxpayer acted reasonably and in good faith, and the grant of relief does not prejudice the benefits of the government. To meet the first point, generally, if you show that you gave all necessary information to an advisor who you intended to advise you on making the election and tell you about the mechanics to be involved in making such an election, and the advisor basically doesn't get it right, that's usually considered to be adequate to show you acted in good faith and reasonably. The second bullet point is, can be a problem with certain elections simply because the IRS also wants to make sure that people don't basically game the system by getting a benefit from making a late decision. Generally, you need to show that either there was always an intent to make the election in place, and perhaps, as in this case, you prepared the returns as if the election had been made, and you also can show there was no benefit. You know, there's no real advantage to you from waiting now and making your decision today. There's not some reason why now we're better off knowing certain things have occurred, so we'll make this late election. In this case, the service does it. The big thing takeaway here for you to understand is the IRS is very willing to grant this late relief if you ask for it. However, if they discover it on exam, they are much less willing to give this relief. And it does not have to be a new preparer. If you go back to February of this year in private letter ruling 2014-08-007, and I should say this year, we're now in 2014, you might be listening to this in 15, So I mean about 2014 when I say this year. That was a case where the same preparer discovered the error, and interesting enough, in that case, the preparer discovered the error while preparing for an exam that he got a notice on with the client and discovered that the 982 had not been attached. They went in and they got late relief at that point. So as long as the service has not yet uncovered the issue, the IRS is very willing to grant this relief. So always be aware when issues like this are uncovered, whether you uncover it on a return that you prepared or whether you uncover it on a return that had been prepared elsewhere, this benefit is there for the client, and failing to take advantage of this can cause problems down the line when the service notices that lack of election. And suddenly there are consequences that may be very onerous for the client by failing to have corrected that problem. The next item up is we have a chief counsel advice that is actually kind of interesting and useful because clients run into this problem all the time. Cleave Counsel Advice 2014-51027. This deals with a situation where there are multiple owners on a piece of property that is used as a residence, and we have mortgage debt in that case. In this case, three fact patterns were posed to the IRS, to the national office, regarding what happens if we have this situation where we have a joint mortgage holder. And in this case, they look at the three fact patterns. Now, the general rules come under this, and these are put out in all the fact patterns. First, in order to get a deduction for mortgage interest, you must pay the interest. So the party that pays the interest is the one that gets a deduction. Flipping that slightly, that means the party that claims the deduction needs to be able to show that they actually were the party that paid the interest in question. Number two, if funds come from a joint account, it is presumed that those funds come half from each party. So if you have joint ownership on an account and you have essentially a joint ownership of the home, as is quite often going to be the case, then presumptively, unless you can show otherwise, you're going to have to split that between the two parties when it's paid out of the joint account. Now, they look at the three fact patterns. They actually come up with three patterns here where they have effectively. The first fact pattern was when a spouse dies during the year. So the spouse is jointly liable on the debt. One spouse dies partway through the year. And now we get to the end of the year and the other spouse, let's say, files a separate return. So the surviving spouse files a separate return. That may be either because they elect to do so or perhaps they get remarried before the end of the year, in which case they can't file a joint return with the deceased spouse. That tells us that for the period the two were married, you have to look at who paid up through the date of death. And the deceased spouse's return gets whatever that spouse paid. If it came out of the joint account, they remind us of the presumption that half came out of each. Situation two is a case where we have an unmarried couple who are jointly and severally liable on a residence they live in. And they get a Form 1098 issued out to them. With both taxpayers being liable, now we go back to who paid on the debt. And again, if it comes out of a joint account, it is presumed to come 50-50 from each. The third fact pattern deals with where we have related parties basically own a interest in a residence, and there is a mortgage to them. Now, the IRS went kind of off. The national office went off the fact pattern here that had been posed by the Denver office and changed the facts a little to remind them of something. Quite often we see this situation where, let's say, mom and dad go out and get a loan because it turns out son is credit challenged, but son's actually paying on the mortgage and actually is the one who's living in the home. They remind them in this note about the issue of basically having the ability that potentially, even if you're not liable on the debt, that you may be deemed effectively in this case to be considered to be the equitable owner of the property. However, I should remind you that we had a discussion, a case a couple of weeks ago that came up when we talked about the Puentes case, that equitable ownership is going to be determined under state law based on facts and circumstances. So you have to show that state law would recognize that. But if you have equitable ownership, a party who pays the mortgage, even if not liable on the mortgage, if they're the equitable owner of the property, would get the deduction. Otherwise, whoever of the relatives paid the debt is going to be the one that potentially gets a deduction, with the caveat being, as always, that it's still got to qualify as a residence for their purpose, and it may or may not be able to do so, depending upon the fact pattern involved. A quick note for those of you who may deal with cable television systems. The IRS modified the cable system safe harbor repair and capitalization rules to modernize it for the new repair regulations. Revenue Procedure 2015-12 expands upon and revises the older Revenue Procedure 2003-63. It deals with network assets and other issues under the new capitalization repair regulations in the cable system industry. It also provides for automatic method changes. If you are advising or you work for a taxpayer in the cable system industry, you need to take a look at Revenue Procedure 2015-12. It is effective for tax years beginning on or after January 1st of 2014. That means that it would be effective for last year, and you need to decide if you wish to take advantage of this safe harbor, especially if you've been using the older 2003-63 safe harbor rules, because those now effectively are gone. We need to be looking at the new rules. IRS Private Letter Ruling 2014-51004 discussed an issue about an earnout with an installment sale of stock. And this is interesting because it has to do with that issue where we have an earnout provision in a sale. We sold the property. We have the right to earn out. The earnout provisions usually say that as the company performs, you know, we bought, in essence, we sold the stock to a buyer. And let's say over the next 5 years, if the company meets certain sales goals after the acquisition, that our price goes up by certain amounts. Assuming that there is a maximum payout price, the regulations under 453 require us to use that initial maximum sales price as our contract price to start with. In this fact pattern, in year two, it became clear that the maximum would not be earned, and therefore a new maximum was computed. How much could they meet if they met the earnouts they still could possibly meet in year two? And then in year three, it became clear that no earnouts would be met, and in fact, at that point, the sales price would be less than their basis and create a loss. This memo goes through all 3 years' activities. Number one, in year one, you use that maximum sales price as your contract price and recognize gain based on that. Year two, you revise the contract price. You take the revised gain minus the gain you've already recognized and divide that into the payments still to be received, assuming you get the new maximum amount and they recognize under that. Year three, when it's clear there will be a loss on the transaction, you stop reporting on the installment basis and you effectively recognize a loss in that year. The loss in that year will be the remaining payments to be received under this note minus the unrecovered basis in the property to date. So we have a real good walkthrough here. If you have a contingent installment sale, you have a real good walkthrough of all the situations you're likely to face in Private Letter Ruling 2014-51004. I would recommend you take a look at that ruling to give you a real good view of how to work your way out of those situations or how to deal with and advise clients when facing that sort of thing, because earnouts are very normal that we face when we have a sale of a company. A very facts-based opinion, but still important, we have a person that became a real estate professional by simply having a single triplex. This is the case of Smith versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion, 2014-112. This case is very fact-based because what we have here was a disabled veteran who had a single triplex. Due to the nature of his disabilities, it took him longer to do things than it would take someone without similar disabilities. That was important because what the court was able to determine was he met his 750 hours, but it determined he did so not because normally you could meet it with a single triplex, but because due to his disabilities and what he did, he was able to meet those requirements because it just took him longer. They went through details like he took recycling bins out to the street every one day a week, and he would take them back, and there were six of them. They were big. It took him a while to do this. Also went through the fact that due to the recycling bins and being near a recycling center, there were a lot of homeless that would stay by, so every morning he toured the property to see if the homeless had less garbage or trash on the property. He cleaned that up. There were walnut trees he had to rake at certain times of year to clean up when the leaves and stuff came down, the walnut trees or the walnuts came down, or squirrels left shells on the ground. They went through lots of details. He personally managed everything, so he took care of all the repairs. They went through details of specific repairs. This is a case where the taxpayer literally did not have a log, so he didn't have the type of detail we'd like to see, but the court was able to reconstruct. But it is very, very important to note that in this case, this taxpayer primarily won, I suspect, because he was sympathetic, being a disabled veteran, and because the court made it very clear that the facts of his disability were the main reasons why he could meet the 750-hour test. I think the court was making it very clear that they do not want you trying to expand on this case to cover other situations unless you have a similar set of facts or you have documentation of going over the 750 hours, which is something he didn't really have in this case, but the court was able to let it go by. The Treasury this week finalized regulations, Treasury Decision 9707. Form 5472 can no longer be filed separately from the tax return. That Form 5472 is the information return of a 25% foreign-owned U.S. corporation or a foreign corporation engaged in a U.S. trade or business. That was filed with the corporate return. However, under the old regs, if the corporation didn't file a return or filed the return late, you could still file the 5472 on its own and avoid the $10,000 penalty. As it is now, this form must be filed with a corporate return. The IRS apparently was concerned that some corporations were deciding to skip the return and just file a 5472 to get out a $10,000 penalty and not worry about the fact that they weren't going to file the 1120, perhaps because the 1120 would show little or no tax due. Can't do that anymore. The 5472 must be filed with return. This is now effective at this point as of the date it came out on December the 24th, Christmas Eve present. Therefore, interesting case, interesting situation. Finally, the Ninth Circuit went along with the Second Circuit involving a case of the Diebold Foundation versus Commissioner. It was actually the tax court memo case was a Salus Mundi Foundation et al. Versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2012-61. It involved three foundations, all of which were in different circuit courts of appeal. The Second Circuit decided the Salus Mundi case back in November of 13, or in the Diebold case, Diebold Foundation, I should say, in 2013. They reversed the tax court and remanded it. The Ninth Circuit now this year agreed to reverse and remand the case. The IRS did not appeal for the third foundation. Interesting aside that therefore foundation number three is going to get the old tax court decision. The issue in this case was the foundations were indirectly shareholders of a company that sold via a, shall we say, an interesting transaction that was called a Midco transaction that was used to basically sell the corporate assets to a third party. This is a C corp that if there had been an asset sale, there would have been tax inside the corporation, and then there would have been tax when they distributed it out. So the double tax would have cost the shareholders quite a bit of money. They entered into a Midco transaction. This was a marketed tax shelter where a party would agree to buy the corporate stock without reducing it very drastically from what they would have paid for the assets. Might wonder why they'd do that concerning the inside tax. Well, they would form a single-purpose corporation that would itself supposedly have tax attributes that would offset the gain. What this corporation really did was went out and buy a Son of Boss shelter, which, not surprisingly, on exam, the IRS threw out. But the hitch for the IRS was this corporation would liquidate, pay off the loans that had been used by the company, and therefore would have no real assets left over. So the IRS had nobody to collect against. So the IRS went against the original shareholders of the old company, claiming that they knew and should have known that, in fact, this was a fraudulent transfer that was meant to steal from the IRS. The tax court had decided in the original tax court memo decision in 2012 that this did not violate the New York transferee liability law. Therefore, because of that, there was no transferee liability. The IRS appealed that. The Second Circuit found that, in fact, it did. The parties knew enough to trigger New York's law in their view, so the Second Circuit took that position. The Ninth Circuit went along with the Second, but you'll note in reading the decision, the court didn't so much make decisions that the Second was right. They just didn't decide the Second was so radically wrong that they were going to give a split in the circuits. So nevertheless, it is an interesting case. It is a follow-up case to the issues involving the whole Midco transaction marketed shelters. The other side effect of this, there still was to be decided in all of these cases whether the IRS was still too late to the party. They need to have the tax court now decide whether a three-year statute or a six-year statute applied, and also whether technically, now having met the first prong that they would have triggered the New York fraudulent conveyance statute, does that mean, though, they still meet the test to get the federal rules involving transferee liability? So the cases are still to be decided. This has been the tax update for current federal tax developments for the week of December the 29th, 2014, our final 2014 update. Be sure to join us next week when we'll go over the developments in that new upcoming week and the first updates of the new year.